In proportion as the structure of a government gives force to public opinion, it is essential that public opinion should be enlightened.
We are a nation generated by ideas, the beneficiaries of people who took terrific risks and who were a fount, if you will, of originality and ingenuity.
So if people have views that you find offensive, we can either silence them so that nobody challenges us for 4 years, or we can welcome them, debate with them, and try to hash it out and make us all smarter.
By the time this comes out on Tuesday, something may have happened. But something has not happened now, so we are not talking about the riots this week. We are not talking about the numerous and sundry and various rumors surrounding potential for future violence, anything like that. I don't really care about addressing rumors as much as I do about actual things that occur. But I also think it's kind of nice to avoid the doom scrolling. So this week we are going to return to the topic of history, not as an escape, but rather as an alternate way of looking at issues and an alternate way of trying to cope with the world around us and respond to the world around us. So we are going to talk about great historical leaders, kind of in line with what we've done with the presidents, but much more deliberate, much more slow, and much more ongoing than we have done before. Obviously, if we're talking history, Jason is here with us this week.
Hello there.
So, Jason, I can see you're drinking something, and I suspect it is once more a chance for you to whore for SodaStream. But would you like to whore for SodaStream this week?
Hi, guys. Jason Clicker here with another advertisement for SodaStream. Now, you may be wondering, Jason, why do you still feel this way about SodaStream? Because it's delicious, quasi-nutritious, and doggone it if it isn't convenient.
I like how you say semi-nutritious. It's like, well, I mean, it does contain like 300% of your daily sodium intake, most likely.
Indeed. Indeed.
I am drinking London Dry Gin by Castle and Key Distillery out of Kentucky. It was given to me as a Christmas gift because one of my friends knows I really like gin, and he was visiting Kentucky at the time. He's like, let me try this. And I was like, oh, it's a London Dry, because the person we're talking about today, Alfred the Great, actually, he wasn't the ruler of London. London was actually part of the Mercian territory, but he did liberate it and then return it to Mercia, which is kind of one of the reasons we're talking about him. So I'm like, this is as close as I can get to on theme. I guess it also has the word castle in it. This is a London Dry, which means all the botanicals were distilled and given and put into the mash as part of the distillation process, not added subsequently. It's gotten less of a, you know, have, I mean, I don't know if you're one of the ones who believes this, but a lot of people say gin tastes like a Christmas tree. This does not taste like a Christmas tree. It does have juniper in it, but it actually tastes a lot more like chamomile and the lemon verbena and the angelica root. It has a bunch of herbal notes beyond juniper that are actually more prominent. So it's really interesting for a gin.
Alcohol exists. That's my opinion.
Okay. Before we get into the topic of Alfred the Great, I think it's worth, you know, when we did the presidents, it was kind of understandable why we were doing the presidents. I think there's a bit more of a question there and a bit more explanation needed for why we would choose to do non-American leaders, because everyone in this series can't be American. So the question is, why would we learn from these people? What do we have to learn from these people? Why really study these people? Because again, we're not using history as an escape here. We're using history as a way to learn about the past, and through that, learning about the present. So why do you think we should study and learn from these great leaders in history?
Well, I think that, first off, well done, Aaron. What a great question to start this off with.
Oh, thank you.
Let us pat ourselves on the back here.
Yes, quiet.
Yes, quiet, yes. A lot of my kids have been asking me questions like this as well, because you would have to be a very foolish person to not understand that we live in very scary and broken times. However, I have quite a bit of optimism about how things will go in the future. And one of the reasons that I have such optimism is because I think that there is a solution that a lot of people are interested in discussing, where that is, we end up making our own individual communities better. And by a bunch of people making their communities better, we benefit the nation entirely, if enough people do it. And I have encouraged my kids, you know, that in less than 2 years, many of them will be adults in full legal standing, and that people will be looking to them for leadership. And so it is necessary, especially if you are going to be going into any sort of leadership position, to understand what truly makes a good leader. And to not just get all of your information from the American culture. Because as the great Uncle Iroh from Avatar The Last Airbender tells us, if all of your information only comes from one place, it becomes stale and useless. So I think that it's very wise for us to look back in history, look at these people who existed in such trying and difficult times, unprecedented times, if you will. Thank you to all of the ad companies saying that nowadays.
I just escaped it on Hulu, and now you're doing this to me.
During these unprecedented times, to look at them and see what they did to make themselves better. Because this is something that is truly extraordinary about American history, and honestly, most of the Western Hemisphere as well. We have had a remarkably peaceful existence compared to the rest of the world. We do not have the cultural memory of hardships that an England or, oh my goodness, especially a Russia would have.
Mostly self-inflicted, but yes.
Oh, those Russians. So I think that it is a really good idea for us to look at examples that may not be American to see what this good leadership is, what we can learn from them, and then how to apply it in our own lives, in the lives of people that we influence.
I think that's a really good point, especially, I mean, it's ironic that I'm about to say this because we are talking about an English king, but there's this idea, I think, especially within the broader cultural discourse, it's even prominent within our own intellectual circles. You know, I come from a similar liberal arts background to you. You work in the liberal arts now, and you teach classical education. And there's this idea of America has this one intellectual bloodline, I would say. Or at least I think that on the extremes, some people like to make that claim. You can trace, you know, English, you know, the Magna Carta, John Locke, America. And maybe if you go back a little farther, some people will say, you know, oh yes, Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, Rome, the Magna Carta, you know, John Locke, America, which I just think is absurd to the point of sheer stupidity. And we instead come from a much more varied background. I mean, for instance, John Adams, one of his personal political idols was Niccolo Machiavelli. It's not particularly well known or remarked upon, but he was one of the first English translators of Machiavelli's Discourses on Livy, keeping in mind that Machiavelli wrote The Prince mostly out of sarcasm and not as a serious guide to gain power. And Machiavelli's principles in the Discourses on Livy definitely reflect into John Adams' own personal political views. Similarly, you know, John Locke or Thomas Jefferson, both major figures in our intellectual history, Jefferson in our literal history, they admired and learned from totally non-European figures. John Locke and Jefferson both made a case for tolerance of Muslims based on the case of Saladin and Suleiman the Magnificent, saying that this was proof that these people had as much of a right to be here as we did, and they shared a lot of our cultural DNA. Well, I say our as if I was part of this, but the cultural DNA that would later become America, the ideas that would later become America, they were appealing to a Turkish and a Kurdish leader. And so first off, I would say that, you know, the idea of what actually is our intellectual bloodline and who has contributed to our sphere and our influence and our intellectual heritage is a lot more diverse than, say, your average alt-right guy screaming they will not replace us wants to admit. I'd also say that, you know, we're in these unprecedented times, as you say, and the idea that, you know, I mean, you mentioned we've had a very peaceful history, but really, it depends on how you interpret that, in the sense that most of the countries in the Western Hemisphere are relatively new, and whether you want to say because of colonialism or because of other forces, a lot of them are very divorced from what happened. I mean, we're talking about Alfred the Great. The major other events of that century in terms of world influence involved the downfall of the Mayan Empire. Like, a lot of these previous histories are things that don't influence the modern countries the same way that, say, England still owes things to Alfred, right? So there are going to be situations in history and across cultures that we've never faced before in our brief 300-year history, but we will face something similar to them moving forward. Because even if you don't believe history is cyclical, it does tend to repeat itself. So I think there's a lot of import to developing your thinking and your worldview based on so-called others' history, because you may end up facing a similar situation, and it may not actually be others' history as much as you want to think.
And just to assuage the listeners, because yes, we're talking about how all of these great cultures have something to teach us, and then we're going to talk about an English king today. His Englishness is not what makes him special here. It is more of his personal character and his own actions that we'll be discussing and looking at. This really could have been in any other country, and I think that we would still feel as we do about Alfred.
Oh, absolutely. And there are other, you know, much more exotic, to use a somewhat loaded term, names on this list. Alfred ended up where he did because he's so remarkable. And even to call him English, I think, in a lot of ways, is a vast oversimplification, really, considering the history of his own time and what he was doing. He's here for what he accomplished, not just because he's English, even though it is a little bit funny that we're talking about otherness and then going back to 9th and 10th century England. Now, the last time when we talked about presidents, and the last time we did a formal ranking of the presidents, and we did something similar with the founding fathers, but it wasn't quite as formal. I know you had very formal criteria. I have learned from my mistakes, and I also have formal criteria. I know they are, however, different criteria, but they both involve numbers, so they're good. So how are you going to be evaluating the people that we talk about during this ongoing series?
Much like with my presidential categories, I shall be using a point system, 1 through 5, 1 being the worst you could be and 5 being the best that you could be, to rank these people. But because we're going from such different cultures and from such different time periods, I have changed the category slightly to make them just a tad more timeless. There is one where you could argue that they are a product of their time, but for the rest of them, I think that it's all fairly timeless stuff that people can apply no matter who they are or where they are in their life. So the first category I have is personal character. I am of the firm belief that you cannot have two different types of morality. You cannot be a good person publicly while being a horrible person privately. You may have that act for a little bit of time, but eventually it will catch up with you. You have to be a good person in order to be a truly good leader. Inevitably, there will be consequences if you are not. So personal character is a part of my ranking. The second part is composure. There are many, many great people in history who do great things in peaceful times. Calvin Coolidge, for instance, is one of my favorite presidents to have ever lived. I wouldn't give him that high of a composure ranking, because he never had a great crisis that truly defined who he was. Most of the leaders that I will be looking at as we go throughout this podcast and over these next several weeks, they had several crises that helped forge them into the person they became. And so I want to rank their composure. How well did they do in this situation, and why did that work? The third category, and the only one that you may be able to make an argument that this is more being a product of their time, is tolerance. I think the greatest thing a leader can have intellectually is to be able to have an open mind, but not so open that your brain falls out, that you are too easily swayed by whoever it was that talked to you last. So how tolerant were they of different cultures, different ideas, different beliefs? Because I think any study of economics or even human history, especially the United States, tells you that when you have a diversity of thought and opinion and you are able to let them peacefully coexist with one another, it results in prosperity. Would you agree with that as well, Aaron?
I mean, yes, but I have had the word pluralist thrown at me, and it was meant as an insult. I didn't take it as an insult.
You filthy communist, tell ya.
It's like, how can you tolerate bad ideas? Bad ideas have consequences. And I'm like, yes, but a lot of people think my ideas are bad, and I think your ideas are bad, and I'm not coming at you with a hatchet. So I'm a pluralist.
My fourth of five categories is prosperity. presidents in American history have used this quote all the time. You should vote for me because you're better off now than you were before I came into office. And while it is cliche and overused, that doesn't mean that it's any less true. So was their country a better place after this leader was done with their rule? Was this a better situation than when they first arrived on the scene? I think that that's absolutely necessary, because you can be the greatest, most virtuous, composed, and tolerant person in the world, but if you cannot produce effective results, I don't think that that really makes you a good leader. My final category is one that I call protector. How good of a protector were they? I am a big believer in the John Locke school of governmental philosophy, which says that the government's primary job is to protect your natural rights of life, liberty, and property. So how good of a job did this ruler do at protecting the natural rights of their people? That's going to be my fifth and final category for how to rank these people.
Moving forward, I genuinely might just take your five, and so that way we're talking the same language. And there actually might be one that I add into yours. I don't know. We'll see. But for this episode, at least, I do have three. My first is desirability. And the question is, would I want to live under these people based on everything else available to me at the time? If the choice is between 2021 and any other point in history, my answer is always going to be 2021. I like vaccines. I like supermarkets.
Penicillin is one hell of a drug.
Penicillin is a hell of a drug, and it's a good drug. And I think people who have a nostalgia for the past, not all of them, but I think many of them are silly and reductionistic. A lot of people like to say, oh, things were better back in the era when one could just sit and learn. Yeah, if you were a noble, sure, you got to sit around and learn things. But let's not pretend that being a poor person in the modern era is a lot nicer than being a serf. Even as good as I think Alfred was, I'd rather be a poor person today than a serf in his time. For starters, my life expectancy is longer, and I'm not going to lose as many children to plague. But for the time, are they desirable to live under? And I think that's really important, because I do think there's an element of comparison that's inherent to saying if somebody's good or bad. And I think if you wouldn't want to live under somebody, you have no business recommending it to someone else. The same way if it's like, oh, you know, you should eat or drink this food. Do you eat or drink it? No, then don't recommend it. In line with that that idea of standing out, my second category is uniqueness. Are they exceptional compared either to those around them, who are their peer rulers, or are they unique and set apart based on who came before and after them? Something has to set them apart and make them stand out. And finally, their legacy. And this is another important thing, I think, and that's, you know, we're going at this with a purpose. We're not just saying who in history would we have a beer with. It's who do we want to learn from? And so legacy is kind of subjective in the sense that I'm going to score them out of five on legacy for whether or not I think they have something important to teach us today relevant to challenges that we currently face, or they have something to teach us because they faced a similar challenge that we failed and they succeeded at. So I'll be giving scores out of 15. You'll be giving scores out of 25.
We may end up giving them scores out of 30 in the future.
So Alfred the Great. Alfred the Great is surprisingly a part of the current sphere if you're into historical fiction. If you watch the show Vikings, he is a major character in the seasons that, well, at least season 5 and 6, I want to say. Regardless, he's a major figure in Vikings, although I would say that is the worst depiction of him because it has essentially nothing to do with him. He's also a character in the recently released Assassin's Creed Valhalla, and also a major character, he was a major character, in Netflix's The Last Kingdom, which is my favorite depiction of him is from The Last Kingdom, as much as I do love the Assassin's Creed franchise.
I give, just really quickly, I'm sorry, I'm just plugging all sorts of stuff that we're not getting paid to sponsor here on this podcast. Go watch The Last Kingdom. It is on Netflix still, I believe. It is a wonderful historical miniseries that is based off of an English author's book who researched and then wrote a quasi-accurate retelling of his own family's legacy. I cannot recommend it highly enough. Just go watch it. You won't be disappointed. Maybe you will, but that's fine.
So, Alfred the Great. Much like the current monarch of England, Queen Elizabeth, Alfred was never meant to be king. He was not born to be king. He was a younger son, and he was the secundarius, which means he was in line to the throne, but he was never really expected to succeed it. His brother Ethelred had an agreement with him where they basically said, whichever one of us dies first, with the invasion of the Vikings very imminent, whichever one of us dies first, the other one becomes king. Ethelred died, his sons were incredibly young, and so Alfred became the king, and there was really no controversy about this. No, there was no succession crisis or anything like that. He did not have to murder his nephews or anything to that effect. He just indisputably became the king. And he was facing a problem that had been faced by England, and we should mention England does not exist at this point. It's called England because of the Angles, who would later join with the Saxons. They were called the Anglo-Saxons. That's where that comes from. East Anglia, Mercia, Northumbria, and Alfred's own Wessex are the four major kingdoms of England at the time. And by the time Alfred takes the throne, for almost a century, the Vikings have just been raiding Ireland and Scotland, and especially England. And right before he was king, they had launched a full-scale, 100% meant to conquer invasion. It wasn't just meant to seize gold or slaves. They were meant to come and conquer England. So I think that right off the bat, Alfred, the deck is stacked against him.
Here's an indication of how bad the situation was. Alfred's older brother, Ethelred, had two young sons. They were only a year or two away from legal adulthood when Ethelred died and Alfred became king. But the situation in England was so bad at the time that when they were both at the age of legal inheritance, neither one of his two sons ever put forth a claim to the throne. They said, oh, we want no part in this. It's clearly going to be a losing effort. We will let Alfred take all the blame for this failure and let the Vikings destroy him instead of us.
Why don't we go through with the history based on your criteria, and then I'll kind of do mine as a summary, because I think I'll address mine are more broad.
Sure.
And I can address mine really quickly at the end while we're doing the final tally. But I think yours will help us go through the history more sequentially, or at the very least hit the highlights.
Well, I just want to say, first off, thank you so much for letting me do this, because I'm an American history teacher. So very rarely do I get to talk about anyone who is not an American. And Alfred the Great may be my second most favorite person in history after Christ. And I'm not kidding. Even over the incredible admiration I have for Washington or some of the other founding fathers, I think that I may still admire Alfred over them a little bit more. He is just a fascinating character. So thank you for letting me geek out over someone who I have secretly been wanting an excuse to talk about. And you would be amazed at how little my wife asks me about Alfred the Great in the course of our marriage. Like, not once, as we are ever sitting there cuddling at night, never once has she gone, babe, tell me about Alfred the Great. So this is, thank you. I appreciate this opportunity.
Get on with your freaking
categories. I know. I am also not the only one who feels this way about Alfred, by the way. One of the most prominent English historians of the Victorian era, when they were paying all of the very best people to research English history. This one of the best historians, Edward Freeman, wrote a book called The History of the Norman Conquest of England. And in that book, this historian describes Alfred as the most perfect character in history. He is probably one of the very few people who has ever truly deserved their title of the Great that history has given to them. Getting into his personal character, I was debating with you, I hemmed and hawed a little bit before this video, but I have eventually ended up giving him a 5. And one of the reasons I do this is not only because there are no stories passed down to us of Alfred ever engaging in any actions that we would find morally reprehensible. Nothing major has ever passed down there. No bastard children, no accusations of court intrigue where he murdered or poisoned someone. Not only is there nothing of that nature, but there are also many stories in the opposite direction where people talked quite a bit about Alfred's humility and his wisdom and his courage. A very famous parable about Alfred, and while we can never know for sure if this is true or not, because the first written account happened 100 years after his death, there is strong evidence to suggest that this was something that was passed around word of mouth style for quite some time. And it essentially was that after Alfred's army had lost a horrible defeat against the Vikings that were invading, he was given shelter by a peasant woman who was unaware of his identity. And she said, "I have some chores to take care of, so I wish for you to watch the cakes that I have left cooking on this fire." Well, Alfred is so preoccupied with the problems of his kingdom that he's lost in thought, and so he lets the cakes burn and is scolded by this woman. And there are even some accounts that she actually picks up a stick and sort of gives him a lashing afterwards as well, thinking that he's just some common soldier. "And how dare you burn my cakes? Take this, I'll show you a lesson about responsibility." And so Alfred eventually leaves the house and gets his army back and wins an incredible victory over the Vikings. But he goes back to this woman's house, and instead of punishing her or giving her a counter scolding, the legend has it that Alfred actually got down on one knee and thanked her for that lesson in humility and diligence and responsibility, and gave him the inspiration he needed not to worry about the events of tomorrow, but to only really focus on what he could control today. And while there is no way we can know for sure, as I've already said, you don't see a whole lot of legends talking about the virtue of Alexander, for instance, or the virtue of Caesar. So I think that the fact that these people are wanting to talk about him in this way is a really good indication of just how good his personal character was. So he gets a 5 for personal character. And then for composure, he also gets a 5. We have mentioned this several times before, that Alfred had just about the worst possible starting point you could as a king. Out of the 4 great English kingdoms during this time period, his is the last free and independent kingdom that has not been taken over by some Viking warlord. He is outmanned. Many of his best warriors have already died in the fighting before Alfred even takes the throne. So he has got this junior varsity squad going up against an all-star team. And yet somehow, throughout all of this, he keeps his cool. He understands that there are weaknesses to the Viking army that he can exploit, and so has the foresight to exploit them, and starves them into submission, and plays them off against one another, and decides, and you know, we talk about composure, keeping cool in stress. Another part of composure is that you are not overeager in your victory as well, that you do not press your luck too hard or get too arrogant upon the backs of continued success. And one of the things that allowed Alfred to have such a stable kingdom is that he would look at all of his defeated enemies, and he would say, "As long as you convert to Christianity, I have no problem with you. And you must sign a peace with my kingdom as well. But I will not force you to leave the country. I will not force you to give up hostage after hostage. You are allowed to own property and have all the rights that free Englishmen have, as long as we can live in harmony with one another." He knew exactly when to stop as well, which is an important part of composure.
I'll push back against that a little. I mean, and I say when I mean a little bit, I mean a very little bit, because even though he did require, after the Battle of Edington, he does require the Viking leader, Guthrum, to convert to Christianity and be baptized. His baptismal name is Æthelstan. But even though Æthelstan has to become a Christian with Alfred as his godfather, paganism is legal in the Danelaw.
Right, no.
He doesn't require that everyone else become Christian, only Guthrum.
I might have exaggerated, and from what I've seen here, yes, Guthrum had to as well. There were other leaders, especially as he's playing the Viking warlords against one another. If a warlord is on the edge of defeat, he will have the warlord in charge convert to Christianity, and that is usually enough to keep people in line. But no, you are correct. He does not have them all convert to Christianity. It's not some sort of mass conversion, which probably would have been insincere in the first place, and Alfred knew that.
Well, yes, but it does, because he himself admired and tried to emulate, or he thought he was emulating. I would argue he did a bad job at emulating, and that's a good thing. Charlemagne. And Charlemagne was a fan of mass conversion. He was a fan of, I will kill every single man, woman, and child in your tribe if they don't all convert to Christianity, because I am the Roman Emperor. Whereas the fact that Alfred does say, I don't care what your people do. The only reason I'm making you convert is I can't have peace with a pagan king because you could be lying to me. And even there, the entire reason this situation had devolved is there had been previous peace treaties before Alfred. The Vikings didn't think that they had to keep their word with English people. Now, I will say this in defense of the Vikings. They had a lot to admire about their society. But the Vikings did have a lot to admire. They did. They had a very strong sense of individualism, very strong sense of individual rights and stuff like that. If you too were Danish, and back in this time, Danish means any Scandinavian, from Denmark, Sweden, Norway, you know, it didn't matter to them. They were all considered Danes. If you were not a Dane, they could lie to you. So when Alfred forces them to convert, there's a practical element to it too. He's like, oh no, now you're part of my tribe, you're a Christian now, and you can't break faith with me this way. And so I think that there's a very noted practicality to that that I think is actually in another way kind of admirable as well, in that he's not a religious crusader the way many of his peers were.
Agreed. Now we get to tolerance, and we've already kind of gotten into tolerance already a little bit here. I think we've been bleeding into it. For tolerance, I give Alfred a 4. The only reason that I give him a 4, and if I could give him a 4.5, I probably would. We do not see anything regarding Alfred concerning Jewish people or any of the other minorities that existed in Europe at this time. And so while that may indicate that he didn't do anything bad towards them, we also don't know if they were given protection under English law, because a lot of times European rulers would just sweep the Jewish question under the rug. And it was out of sight, out of mind, which is what happened a lot of times in early American history as well. Out of sight, out of mind. And I don't give America a pass for that, and so I won't give Alfred a pass either. But it is a very strong showing of 4, just because of how tolerant he was. Not only towards other religions and beliefs, but also towards different ideas as well. This is something that I will touch on more in the prosperity section, but Alfred creates a lot of universities, and not just biblical Christian study universities either. He wanted his people to engage in philosophy and discussion, and to make his court a place of both learning and debate, where people could have different ideas and they didn't have to feel worried that they would go to their king and say something that he personally disagreed with, and then be executed for it. So I think that that is a wonderful feather in his cap for tolerance. But I shall let you discuss Dane law.
I'm going to make the case you should up it to a 5, and maybe I'll persuade you. I appreciate the Jewish question and the question of minorities in Britain in general. There's no evidence that there actually were. There were probably a few, because Britain really starts, it's the history that we have of it, like actual somewhat reliable history with the Romans, and there were always like silversmiths and stuff that Jewish people would tag along. But the first real presence of Jewish people in Britain comes with the French, almost 100 years after Alfred. So there's really no history. I wouldn't say that there's really any evidence of him being intolerant, but why I'd say give him a 5, and it does primarily go around the Dane law and the educations, the things you have yourself have mentioned. There's this idea with the modern alt-right, you know, we will not be replaced, or you will not replace us, or they will not replace us. They meaning minority X at the time. It can mean people of Latin descent. It can mean Jews. It can mean Muslims, which isn't even an ethnicity, but try telling that to the current American political sphere. It's an absurd thing to shout in American politics, and absurd is a nice way of putting it. Evil is probably better. But in 9th century and 10th century and 8th century before it, Britain, they will not replace us is actually kind of a valid thing to be worried about, because the great heathen army, as it called itself, under the leadership of 5 Viking chiefs who claim to be the sons of the mythical leader Ragnar Lothbrok, they are there to replace you. They want to kill your kings. They're there to take over the entirety of Britain and enslave the people. They want Britain to become a part of their larger empire that they have cultivated around this area. They've already taken Iceland. Iceland is already thoroughly under their control. They've tried to take Greenland and realize it's terrible. Britain's next. If you just look at the geography, it just makes sense that they would go to Britain next. And so what happens with Alfred is, he, through military genius, he does beat them at the Battle of Edington. And he, as we mentioned, he beats Guthrum. He makes Guthrum be baptized as Athelstan. And then he makes peace, and he makes a lasting peace. He doesn't just say, we own you. He doesn't make them conquered. He instead establishes an entire part of England that is called the Danelaw. It's under Danish control. So while all the Angles and the Saxons and the Anglo-Saxons are united behind Alfred, he's almost the de facto king of England, even though there are 4 separate kingdoms at this point, all the Danes can now live in the Danelaw. And it's fundamental to peace, because here's the thing. Alfred would have been completely within his rights, and certainly would have probably been expected, that he says, get the hell out of my country, I don't want any Saxons, I don't want any Danes left in England. But it wasn't as simple as just kicking them out, because there had been, you know, there had also been a history of actual settlement. There had been more minor deals made with previous kings and noblemen where Vikings had legally settled. Some of these Vikings had been there for a decade or two at this point. They'd kind of become integrated. They had farms. They had a life. So just kicking them out, perhaps, say, one might even use the phrase building a wall or something similar, isn't simple then or now. And so he's like, well, we can't kick them out. We can't. It's not going to happen, because, again, we've beaten them in one battle, but they basically already own this turf, and if I try to go in there with a military, I'm fighting them on their own turf, and they're going to dig in, and we're all going to suffer. So instead, we are going to hybridize our laws with their laws, and they will be allowed sovereignty. Part of this treaty involved them saying, you can still be pagan, but I expect no mistreatment of English people within your own borders. They created a common law code, and They are slightly different. It was written down. Alfred tried to find the similarities between Saxon culture, Germanic, and Nordic culture, also Germanic, albeit slightly different. So, say, for one perfect example is that the idea of reparations. And the English had the idea of reparation. You steal something, you owe something back. You commit a crime, there's some sort of financial compensation that can be given back. The Danish had one called Vergilt. Same basic idea. They had all. He sought out these commonalities, and he forged a new law system. And the Danelaw became basically a free area of Britain, and they could continue to be who they were, but they weren't going to raid as much. There was no more invasion problem. There were still raids after the Danish, and Alfred did not take that lying down from them after the Danelaw was established. But by finding that common ground, he basically stopped the great heathen army in its tracks, and it was perfectly desirable to live there. And I think that's what gives him I would give him a tolerance score of 5.
So I also realized something. So you know what? I will be changing it to a 5. So congratulations. Alfred gets a perfect score. On the rating thing, because this is something that I remembered from my own research, is that, yes, Alfred also is one of the people who sets that iron solid bedrock of only punishing the person who is guilty of the crime, and that guilt by association does not lead to actual conviction, because Alfred only punishes the people who raided. He does not punish any of the Danes who happen to live in the area where these raiders and pillagers came from. He did not retaliate with a raid of his own and purge them with fire and sword. He kept his cool and solidified the individual concept of justice, which is so so very important.
And in line with that, and I think this will be a nice lead into your prosperity topic, he was a huge legal reformer. It wasn't just the Dane Law. I have a quote from him that when he issued his own legal code, and he said, "I have ordered to be written many of the laws that our forefathers observed herein, but however, only those that pleased me. And many of the ones that did not please me, I have rejected, given the advice of my counselors, and either commanded them to be observed in a different way or not to be observed at all." End quote. He set out to explicitly enact legal reforms, and he was a big believer in mercy. He was a very devout Christian, and he believed that mercy was something very important for a ruler to practice. So in a lot of ways, and this is why he's so different, what sets him apart, he's kind of the first anti-death penalty king. He abolishes the death penalty for all crimes except for treason. Now, he doesn't abolish. He reforms the death penalty for every crime except treason. It is no longer required for anything except treason. Now, there are, you know, nuance, like, for example, with murder, that would require a lot of nuance. But for most things that were otherwise considered standardly punishable by death, he said, you can pay your way out of it. You can offer Wehrgeld. And that's fine. He takes away a lot of power from magistrates. He also explicitly and particularly reviews how his more local magistrates and lesser magistrates are ruling. And if they were unfair to anyone, regardless of social class or background, if they were unfair to, you know, there were Danish people who settled outside of the Dane law. If they were unfair to those Danish people or to poor people, he'd have them removed. He took a very involved view of the justice of his country, and that's why I think he'd be pretty nice to live in and pretty cool to live under, because it was a good place to live generally regardless of what class you are, to say nothing of the fact that he is a major – and this isn't something I know about. I think it's more of your area. But he was a major advocate for education and literacy as well. He has all these things, including parts of the Bible, translated into Old English, and he has at least young men, which for the time was pretty progressive, of all classes taught how to read English. Only if you are of a higher class do you have to learn Latin. Everywhere else in the world, if you want to be educated, Latin's the language. He's the first one really on the world stage to say, actually, it should be in your own language. It should be done in your own tongue. So I think he's remarkably tolerant and remarkably, in a good way, progressive towards a more equitable and individualistic and rights-respecting governance. I think I also just touched on protectorate as well, but
you are so spot on with talking about his education stuff. I'll get into that a little bit, but yes, for prosperity, it is an easy 5. I wish I could give him a 6 or a 7, but much like Alfred, I must too respect the rule of law, even if I have created it. And so he has a 5 out of 5 for prosperity. Let's focus militarily first. He comes into it in a state of war, a state of near collapse and destruction. He leaves his kingdom as the strongest of the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms in England. And even though he never claims the title himself, he has established himself as the protector of all English people. And it allows his son to further consolidate that power. And his grandson becomes the first ever king of England. And it only comes about because of the prosperity that Alfred left behind. But one of the things that allowed his prosperity to thrive as much as it did is, like you said, his insistence upon education. Because there have been a lot of people who wrote really good law codes, and it did not last very long after their death. I can think of several Roman emperors who had their law codes either amended or completely torn to bits after they were gone because they did not do something that Alfred was very insistent that he practice. Because Alfred is a huge believer in the authority of the church and the state, but that authority comes from people, not institutions. And those people, whether they be a bishop or a bureaucrat, cannot act justly without what Alfred calls the wisdom acquired through study. So he sets up many, many schools and universities throughout the country to ensure that future generations of priests and secular administrators would be better trained. and he encouraged the nobles at his court to emulate his own example in reading and study. If you wanted to convince Alfred of something, you knew that you needed to be able to debate philosophy and law and religious topics with him. He did not care how many boar you had hunted and killed in the woods the other day. He wanted to know whether you could look at this poem and understand something about the human condition while you did so. Were people better off than they were before Alfred arrived on the scene? 150% yes, yes, yes.
So I think we've talked about most of the topics that I wanted to bring up, or we've at least touched on them. Do you want to talk at all about your protectorship stuff separately, or do you think we've talked about that enough?
I will touch on it really briefly, just because I have to give the score. Protector, 5 out of 5. He respected people's life when he defended them from the Vikings, who wished to conquer and slaughter quite a bit of them, and then take the women as their own. He protected not only the liberty of his people, but the liberty of the Vikings who lived in England at the time. And that's an important part that people don't really remember a whole lot, is that while you as a ruler of a country are under no obligation to protect the natural rights of people living in another country, you are obligated to respect them and to take no ill action towards them. And he definitely upholds the liberty of the Vikings. And then with property, the legal codes that he has make it very, very hard to cheat a person out of their property. The beginning of what we consider the English style of liberty begins under Alfred. And when the Norman-speaking kings of England conquer the island in the middle 1100s, they sort of do away with all of these Anglo-Saxon laws about the rights of the people, yada, yada.
Yeah.
But starting with the Magna Carta, but especially in the Renaissance, when this idea of liberty and natural rights starts to become popular again, Alfred is one of the very first kings who gets their reputation restored, because he is the one that they looked to as the ideal protector, who fulfilled the role of government so perfectly. So he gets a 5 out of 5, which gives him a grand score of 30 out of 30.
He also gets a perfect score from me as well, and I would summarize it really quickly. And again, moving forward, we'll probably just hybridize these systems. But for desirability, I think I've made it plain. He gets a 5 out of 5. The only other really major so-called civilized areas you have at this time are France, which is devolved into several separate kingdoms, all of whom are screwing each other over and trying to murder each other. And they're fighting over who gets to be the next true emperor. It's a mess. It's absolutely insane. The Middle East is in shambles at that point in time. The caliphates have not been fully established, and they are currently being established. So if you want to live somewhere where you can be kind of left alone and peaceful, I mean, yeah, you don't want to trade the 21st century for King Alfred the Great. I think it's also an improvement over how England had been previously, because he does introduce the rule of law, and he does do away with things like blood guilt and stuff like that, where you can be punished for other people. So he gets a 5 out of 5 for me there. For uniqueness, I also give him a 5. He conquered the Vikings in a way that I don't think anyone else has ever done. I think you'd be very hard pressed to find something truly analogous to, I've beaten you, now you can stay, and we'll work together. Even the American South and the American North in the Civil War, I don't think it was done. Reconstruction, I do not think, is a good analogy, and it was the closest one I could think of, and then I proceeded to tear it apart for how the Dane law functioned. It wasn't the same. But he also is his championing of literacy across borders and across class structure and class lines was unheard of. It wouldn't be heard of again, really, until John Wycliffe, another English person, and then Luther with the Protestant Reformation, the idea that everyone should be able to read important works of philosophy, theology, and law, that we should empower everyone, not just the nobles. That really, because it's not the Magna Carta, in my opinion. It's something that emerges during the Protestant Reformation and subsequently. And I think that it starts in some ways with Alfred, which is why he gets his reputation restored during that time. And I think today, honestly, especially with the Viking problem, you'd struggle to find someone who had the chutzpah to say, okay, well, here's these people. We've been fighting and killing each other for almost 100 years. but we're going to forge a future together, and we're going to take some of what they have because it's genuinely better than what we do, and they're going to take some of what we have because it's genuinely better than what they have. And again, I don't think anyone else has done that to the extent that Alfred the Great did with the Dane Law. So total 5 out of 5. And my last one, and this is one that, however we do this moving forward, I really think is important to keep, and that's the legacy question. He gets a 5 out of 5 for me. I mean, there was a lot of insanity at the moronic coup attempt a couple weeks ago. But one of the things that stood out to me were the chance of they will not replace us or you will not replace us. And this has been kind of growing at political rallies, and it's been growing in presence, and especially considering that the they generally means Jewish people, it worries me. Especially because even if they're those people who don't mean Jewish people, eventually they will. These ideas of white genocide are very popular and being treated as if they're somehow valid. There's this rhetoric of somehow the enemy is at the gates, which, one, I don't think is even remotely true. I think it's ludicrous to say that cultural change is somehow evil. You know, okay, the ethnic landscape may change, the cultural landscape may change, but America's a nation of ideas and ideals. It's not a nation of one particular language or one particular ethnic group, and it was never supposed to be, and I don't think it should be now. And so what I think that Alfred teaches us about moving forward is, and I'm not saying this is a perfect analogy because it's not, I don't think that, like, undocumented immigrants have somehow and at all affected American society. It is not fair to compare undocumented immigrants to Vikings. So I want to stress that. But in terms of where do we go from here, when we have issues of undocumented immigrants, we have people of other backgrounds and other belief systems coming here. We have a bunch of ideological heterogeneity, excuse me. We move forward by taking the best of what everyone has to offer and changing what needs to be changed. And in an era when conservatism has basically become ridiculous and self-harming support of the status quo, and when progressivism has become basically presentism and self-harming, ridiculous disregard for the past, I think Alfred gives us a nice way forward of you take what's good, you leave what's bad, and you don't just look out for yourself and address constantly what you think has been done wrong. You move forward to the betterment of everyone. So I gave him a 5 here as well, and he gets a perfect 15 out of 15 from me. As you said, I mean, there's a reason we started with Alfred. It's because we both agree on him. I think he's a wonderful historical example. I think he's fascinating. When I eventually play Assassin's Creed Valhalla, I truly hope they don't do him dirty the way Vikings did.
Go watch The Last Kingdom.
Yeah, go watch The Last Kingdom. That's indisputably a wonderful depiction of him. And yeah, he wasn't a perfect human being, and the show doesn't make him into some sort of angel, but it's a really interesting depiction. Moving forward, this is going to be an ongoing series. I mean, we thought about doing it as a top 5, but honestly, I think there's a lot of different. I think this is a really beneficial and ongoing and fruitful way to look at history, because there will always be new problems to look at. And if you want to solve a new problem, you should at least start by thinking how people have solved similar problems in the past. And so I think this should be a lot of fun moving forward. Any final thoughts on Alfred the Great?
I think that right now, where we are in America is similar to Alfred's early reign. We talk about all of this great stuff that happened. We kind of glossed over the fact that the early part of Alfred's reign was horrible. They lost repeatedly. The culture was dying and fractured. I mean, my goodness, their own king had to flee the battlefield in disgrace and hide himself as a peasant because his life expectancy as a peasant was greater than his life expectancy as a king. This too shall pass. We shall get better. And when that happens, let us work on a way forward, where we can all enjoy this prosperity together.
Well, if you have any thoughts on Alfred the Great, first of all, well done. And if you want to send them to us at contact@libertysnarkpodcast.com, we'd love to hear from you. We'll be back next week. Take care, guys. This has been Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Snarkiness. If you like what you heard, please consider giving us a share on social media or leaving us a review on your podcasting platform of choice. If you'd like to reach out to us, you can find us at facebook.com/libertysnark or send us an email at contact@libertysnarkpodcast.com. Thank you so much for listening.